There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Well, today we're going to be discussing addiction, trying to understand what it is. How do you become an addict? Can anyone be an addict? And what are the first steps to recovery? And how you, in fact, can get help right here in Dubai. Is addiction something that perhaps you have been dealing with or are dealing with right now? It could be alcohol, it could be drugs, or it could be something else. Or maybe you are already on your road to recovery. So let me first of all introduce my guests here. Joining us in the studio over the next 2 hours, Sabine Scar, who's a regular voice on the show, co-owner of the Human Relations Institute and Clinics. She's Assessments Director and a clinical psychologist. Sabine, welcome.
Thank you for having me again.
Pleasure. Nice to see you. We're also welcoming Dr. Prem Shanmugan, who is the CEO and Clinical Director of Solus Sabah, Asia's leading addiction treatment centre and a renowned global expert in the addiction treatment field. Dr. Prem, lovely to have you on the programme.
Thank you for having me, Siobhan.
Thank you. A little bit later on, just after 1 o'clock, we're going to be joined also by Alcoholics Anonymous. They will be sharing their stories with us and offering advice to you again to answer your questions. So I'm going to give those numbers out again. Do keep them handy throughout the show if you'd like to join us. Again, it's a very anonymous way to have some advice, to also share your thoughts and perhaps even share your experiences with us, with our guests today. We're already here to help and to answer your questions. 4001 is the text message number and the phone lines are open as always, 04-423-1010. I'm going to start first of all having a chat with Dr. Prem. It's great to have you here. And you've got an interesting background. You started the clinic in 2014, about, wasn't it?
That's right, about 2014.
But you yourself have also suffered with what you call a disease, and which you managed to gain the ability to actually arrest, to stop, to be recovered. Would you like to share with us your story, first of all?
Sure, that's a pleasure. I battled with addictions for quite a while. I would think about 17 to 18 years. From my youth right up to my late teens. Now, no one told me that I had a disease. What everyone told me was, this is a bad habit, you need to kick it, you need to stop it, you know, it's a choice you have made and you live with the choice. And no one told me that I had a disease. After many years, and I got really ill, I was in a hospital in Singapore. I live in Singapore, I'm from Malaysia. And I met a doctor who said, you know what, you're not a bad guy after all, you're a good person. And I said, really? Nobody told me that. They said I was just useless. And then he says, what you have is something we call addiction, which is a disease. And the disease made you do these things. Now, that opened my mind up a lot. And then I asked him, you know, how do I get rid of this disease? What do I need to do? And all he said was, you know, you've been using your brain all these years and your brain got you ill. Now use my brain and we'll help you get better. So I thought, what a crazy psychiatrist this guy is. How do I use your brain? Something's wrong with this man. And then he told me, all you need to do is switch off and allow us to help you. So I tried that. And my life changed since then. And it's been, you know, a couple of years now since I'm in recovery. So what I learned from that experience is that to treat people with addictions. Now, I went back to school after that. I went back to university. I got my degrees. I got my qualifications and my accreditations and all that. So what I realized was that in order to help people with addictions, first, we need to appreciate that they have a problem, a disease. It's not a willpower. It's not about a choice. It may have started off as a choice, but there is a science behind why some people can hold a drink and stop, why some pick it up and cannot stop.
Yeah.
And I felt there's a need to share this with others. So that's how I came into this field.
You're absolutely right. And that is the defining point, isn't it? Perhaps we can start on that then. I mean, what is the definition then of addiction? How do you define it? Is it, it is someone that, you know, as you said, it's either someone that can have a drink and put it down, someone that just can't stop and has to carry on. It might be a drink. I mean, we're not just talking about alcohol. Addiction is addiction to so many different things. It
yes.
might be alcohols, it could be drugs, it could be all those sorts of things. So what's the definition then? What would be your definition of addiction?
Well, I think an easy way to define addiction would be when life becomes unmanageable. When it goes beyond a point where you cannot survive or you cannot live life without the substance or that compulsive behavior.
Yeah.
Now, Siobhan, maybe we should look at what addiction is, like you said earlier. Now, there are two types of addictions within the family of addiction. We call it either substance addiction, which is substance-related, alcohol, drugs, prescribed drugs. And another thing is known as compulsive behaviors,
right?
Process addictions or behavioral addictions, so gambling addictions, internet, you know, and things like that.
So you can actually, so you divide those then? Is that different treatments for those different things?
Actually, it works on the same part of the brain. So what we have found today is that people who have an addiction problem have a deficiency in the reward system of the brain. So is it organic? Yes. Some people are predisposed. Are you born with it? Yes, there is a 30 to 50% genetic predisposition. So you can have it. It's possible. Right. But it doesn't mean if I'm an addict, my child, my son or my daughter is definitely going to be one, because there are other factors that influence this disease as well. Mm. If I may elaborate a little bit.
Please. Yeah.
It's biological, psychological, social and spiritual. So there are four areas which come in like a nice recipe, if we want to use that word, yeah? So there is this biological component, could be genetic, could be something wrong with the body. Psychological, which I think Sabine will be talking about a little later, elements as well. And then there's a social element where if I'm living with a person who's drinking alcohol every day, it's a matter of time before I start drinking as well, right? Then there's a spiritual element, which I think later we're going to talk about with the 12-step group, where we treat people for spiritual deficiencies, or we call them spiritually bankrupt. Now, spirituality here refers to values, belief system, moral. You know, I'm not a bad person after all. I need to change that belief system. So we need to treat that aspect of the individual as well. Mm.
But all of those, I imagine, are combined as well. I mean, or can you just be biologically addicted, or could you just be psychologically addicted? They're all combined, aren't they?
It is. So we have to treat all areas when, you know, working with someone who's got an addiction problem.
Do you think then that those that may have people in their family who have been addicts, it could be parents, it could be uncles, it could be whoever, people in their families, that you perhaps sometimes have to look a bit closely or more closely at your behavior? Is that something that perhaps you should be more aware of?
Yeah, that's possible. Because if working with people with addictions, we have found that there are other members in the families as well. In fact, these are some of the initial questions that we ask them. You know, maternally or paternal side, do you have family members who have an addiction problem, or do you have people who have compulsive disorders in the family? Is mental health an issue within the family? Because there is a correlation between mental health issues and people using substances to self-medicate as well.
Yeah, that's a whole other side as well that we will talk about as we get into the show, is the prescription drugs and drugs that are used for depression, drugs that are used for various other different things, and an addiction to actually prescription drugs. So you might think, well, I'm not an addict. My doctor has prescribed these drugs to me. I'm not like on the streets and buying drugs or whatever, which way you get them. This is actually something that's been prescribed to me by my doctor.
Exactly.
Does that still make me an addict? Mm. So again, there's a huge rise globally in prescription drug addiction around the world. And I can share with you some stats a little bit later on as well. So it's interesting to get that sort of definition of addiction, and then is that really the starting point for you, for people that you see, is to understand which areas of the addiction that need to be worked on, or which areas are the most prevalent or the most poignant? Is that how you start to look at those different areas?
Okay. One of the difficulties in working with people with addictions is the fact that they find it difficult to accept that they have a problem.
Yeah.
Okay. So denial is the first. Generally, yeah, one of the first common presenting symptoms in people with addictions. I don't have a problem. I can stop when I want to. My wife thinks I have the problem. My boss thinks I have the problem. I don't really have a problem. These are the things we commonly hear. Now, the reason for that is because, you see, once this is a disease, okay, and the brain, we say that the brain or the reward system is hijacked. Once this happens, the person goes into denial because he or she thinks that I need this to survive. I need this to function. Without this, I cannot function. So don't take it away from me. You cannot take it away from me because I cannot see myself living without it. Now, I have lived like that for many years of my life as well. I could never see myself living without my alcohol. I was suffering from alcohol addiction. And I could never imagine stopping. I never imagined a life without it because my brain sent me messages that I needed. It helped me to a certain extent initially. Unfortunately, what happens with time is the body builds a tolerance. So you need more and more of the same substance to get the same kind of effect. And then more to get even a better or stronger effect. So that's why we hear of people overdosing, people becoming psychotic as a result of the drugs. So when we work with the patient or the client who comes with an addiction, we try not to look at them as someone who is self-inflicted or someone who has lost his willpower. In fact, we look at them as patients and tell them, you know what, how can I help you? What do you need to get yourself better in life?
Right.
Yeah, what can I do for you? They have already heard lots of names already. They've had that.
So the starting point then, what is the actual starting point to the perhaps often rocky road to recovery? What is that starting point? Is it, for some, it could be just hitting rock bottom. Absolutely hitting rock bottom. I mean, I know this has been talked about on the show before, and I did it some time back, of hitting rock bottom. You hear these stories of people ending up on the streets. It was then that I realized that it could be an intervention. We might talk about that a bit later on as well. It'd be something that people have decided to intervene and push you towards it. For you, for people that you've treated, and also Sabine as well, for people who have come to see you, what do you think has oftentimes been that actual starting point, that wake-up point, that aha moment, whatever you want to call it, to go, I need help, I need help?
Well, from my experience in the UAE, it has been when they are made redundant by their work. So because your addiction makes you impaired, you cannot function properly, you cannot do your job properly, you find yourself in dangerous situations at times, you know, you wake up and you don't know where you are. So hitting rock bottom can look different for different people. And you know, the hardest part is to admit that you actually have a problem. We always hear that people say, no, I can stop whenever I want, and I haven't drank in 2 weeks, but when I drink, I can't stop, and I wake up and I don't know where I am. And a lot of, in these situations, they end up at the hospital because they're having a psychotic breakdown. So this is what hitting rock bottom looks like.
Come of the messages that have come through. We talked about addiction. We talked about alcohol addiction. We talked about drug addiction, of recreational drug addiction. The word recreational makes it seem that, oh, it's just, I do it every now and again. It's only a recreational thing. But can you become addicted to recreational drugs?
The answer is yes, you can. Now, I think this goes back to understanding the disease model of addictions. Okay, now, just like alcohol, some of us can have a drink or two and stop and move on. Some of us can smoke hashish, for example, and, you know, during parties or functions and social activities and move on. But some, once they start, they can't stop. So what happens is there is this circuit that is activated in the brain, the reward system of the brain, and then there's a message that goes on in the brain which says, this is good for me because it makes me feel better. It allows me to function better. So you like it. The brain likes it. Then the next time you look for it again automatically because it's my Panadol. You know, it's my cure-all pill, right? Now, when we continue to do this, it becomes a conditioned behavior. Then there's a conditioned response. But like I said earlier, unfortunately, the body builds a tolerance. So you need more and more and more. And at some point of time, you need other kinds of substances as well.
Yeah, it might extend then to others, as they say. Hope that answers the question that came through earlier from one of our listeners. And it's interesting. I must say, I was listening to this incredible TED Talk earlier, and anyone who's interested to check it out online, it's by Johan Harry. And he talks about addiction. I'm not sure if you've seen it or not. He talks about having lived his life with family members who are addicts, having to deal with them, having to try and continue to love them, even though on many occasions he really struggled with that and didn't. And the difficulties of having people that you do love so close to you who are struggling and wanting just to help them, but feeling absolutely helpless that you can't. And he made some really, really interesting and, you know, obviously observances and that could only, I think, come from experience. And he talks about addiction equal bonding, equaling connections, that those that have an addiction, it's about chemical hooks, and it's about finding something that you can bond with. Now, and finding something that you can connect with. Maybe that's a stronger connection than it might than anything else in your life. Is that oftentimes why perhaps addictions can occur? Mm. I mean, how does addiction actually happen? I know we talked about this, something in your brain. It's a chemical that sort of sparks or however which way you want to describe it. But could it also be that something else is missing elsewhere in your life that then you become addicted to or you bond with or you make a connection with something that makes you feel good because other things are not doing that
exactly.
or playing that role?
This is one of my favorite TED Talks. You know, he says that the opposite of addiction is not so sobriety. Yeah. The opposite of addiction is connection.
Mm.
So he was very curious to understand, you know, the roots of addictive behavior and addiction as a disease. So he went about to look at addiction in different societies, different countries, to understand more about that. And he came about an experience by Dr. Bruce Alexander, which was done in the 70s in Canada, in Vancouver. He was a professor of psychology, and it's called the Rat Park Experience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you've heard of it. And the findings of this experience, we're not going to go into too much detail, is that when the lab rats are given opportunity to bond and interact and connect socially and to be busy and find purpose and meaning, they use the water that has drugs in it less than when they are completely isolated and solitary in a cage. And apparently, rats and humans are very similar in their need for connection. So he also made the conclusion that, and this is the same for humans, that when we have emotional and psychological pain, when we feel that we are not good enough, we are not connected, we are not accepted or approved of, we do seek anything that makes us feel better. Just like when you have a physical pain, you want Panadol, you want to put a Band-Aid on a wound, just for symptom relief. And sometimes drugs, alcohol, and other addictive behaviors do provide symptom relief for our emotional and psychological pain. And this is what triggers it initially. And this is when it becomes a vicious circle. And Dr. Pram talked about tolerance, which means we need more of the substance or the behavior to get the same high,
right.
which is reduction of pain.
Mm. It was very interesting, and I think, as I said, yeah, I'd recommend anyone to watch that TED Talk and beautifully explain there. Thank you very much, Sabine. But and there was also another statement, I think he says, it's addiction, another sort of definition of sorts, is not to be able to bear to be present in your own life. Constantly searching for external stimuli, and slightly off on a side, but it just popped into my head now. I don't know if anyone had watched the documentary about Amy Winehouse, who struggled terribly for many years and eventually sort of died from her addictions. And she said at one point, when she was at the height of her career and she was about to receive just tons of awards at this incredibly well-respected musical show, everyone was there, her, you know, all these people that she respected in music, and she was just, you know, on her top of her game. And she went up on stage to collect the award, which should have been probably one of the best moments in her career.
Mm.
And she said, you know what? All I could think about was how much better it would be if I was taking drugs or if I was high on drugs.
Mm.
And I just thought it's just a perfect example of that statement, is that she couldn't bear to be present in her own life at that point, even though her life to the outside might have seemed absolutely amazing. We're talking about addiction, and I'm joined in the studio by Sabine Scaff, who is a clinical psychologist and co-owner of the Human Relations Institute and Clinics, and also Dr. Prem Shanmugam, who is the CEO and clinical director of Solace Sabah, Asia's leading addiction treatment centre. Now, we've had a number of messages come through. Thank you for those who have texted in. It's really great to hear from you. Now, we talked earlier about addiction to alcohol. One of our listeners has messaged in now saying that she quit suffering for 23 years. She'd been suffering for 23 years and will be celebrating 8 years of sobriety next week. Thank you so much for joining us on the line today.
Hello.
Hello. So 8 years, congratulations. That is fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. But it took how many years for you to reach out and get that help and become sober?
Well, I mean, if I were to be honest with myself, I would say that the addiction probably started as soon as I started experimenting with alcohol when I was 15. And that the foray into alcohol was insecurities. And it just, it was a very slow progression into the disease state, into my relationship and my employment. And I had to just take a step back. And it was, you know, several family members had pleaded with me that I had an issue. And I, like your speakers mentioned, I was in denial for a great deal of time. I was like, no, I have total control over this. I can stop anytime I want. But I didn't want to stop. And I felt like I really needed it. I felt like I needed it to be social and to interact. I hadn't formed a personality without it, and it became part of who I was. And so it was a real, very deep-seated addiction from a psychological aspect, for sure. And, you know, once my son was born, after school, I realized I didn't want to be drunk mummy. I didn't want to be the one that would embarrass my child at birthday parties or other places. And he was the real motivator for me to decide to seek help and to take action to change my life and completely turn it around and become 100% sober. And he's what continues to drive me to maintain my sobriety today.
Amazing. Fantastic. I mean, it's such a fantastic story. And 8 years, it's extremely well. And Can you tell me, I mean, you're still, they do say that once an addict, always an addict. Do you still say that you are in recovery?
Yes, and I didn't realize that. When I first quit, I thought I was cured. I thought I was done, and I was no longer an alcoholic, and I didn't understand this whole bit about saying that you are always in recovery. And 8 years out, and also I've started doing my master's in counseling psychology, also because of the addiction, because I wanted to help other people with their addictions, so that's what led me into this new career. And it wasn't until I started doing this intensive master's program that I realized, no, I am actually still in recovery. It is something I still think about on a regular basis. It does definitely become easier, but it is something you have to be cognitive of, and that you have to yourself once in a while. You have to have that mindfulness and awareness of what the stressors are in your life and how to cope with them and manage them in a way that you don't feel you need to resort to something that's going to want you to escape, you know, whereas alcohol was always an escape for me and a way to avoid handling the issues at hand. And so I still feel like there are days where there are challenges. In particular, a very close person in my family who had quit a couple of years ago, and I was overjoyed that she had quit and we were in this together. She recently decided that she would go back to drinking, and I felt really deflated. I felt like my support system was had gone away, and it had me thinking, well, maybe I can start again too. But it's just like, no. I know myself better than that. I can't start again.
You mentioned about your son being your sort of guidance and your real ultimate reason to stop and to quit. What else has it been? What has been something or somebody or something in your life that has really kept you going, has been your crutch to sort of, you know, keep you sober?
Definitely my husband as well. He decided he was not going to drink anymore. He didn't have a problem, but he didn't think it was right that he should be drinking in front of me. I didn't care. I didn't want him to change his ways because I felt that it was a punishment for him that he had to stop drinking because his wife couldn't handle drinking. So, but it was a choice he decided to make, and so I feel less guilty about it now. But having his support and his constantly telling me how proud he is of me and how, you know, it's so nice to have conversations with me when I'm fully present and aware of what we're talking about and actually can remember it the next day. And I'm just less antagonistic without it. And it's just been, he's been a definite cornerstone in my continued recovery.
Hi.
But it's hi.
I'm sorry. Go ahead and finish. Sorry.
No worries.
Yeah, I was just going to say congratulations. That's really amazing what you have achieved.
Thank you.
Yeah, amazing. You know, 8 years is a long time, but then when you look at it at one day at a time, you know, it just makes perfect sense.
And that is exactly the key, and that is something that we learned in our addictions training course as well, is that you cannot say commit yourself to a lifetime of sobriety.
Exactly.
You have to take it day by day, otherwise you're going to set yourself up for failure.
Yeah, because looking at it, lifetime or even a month or a week sometimes is too complicated for a person who, you know, who has an addiction problem. Yeah, so one day at a time makes perfect sense. And I just wanted to say congratulations on your master's course as well. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
Go for it. You know, when I was listening to you, I was thinking about how I started studying when I quit my addiction, or when I came into recovery. I was discouraged from studying. My doctors told me, don't waste your time studying. Go focus on your recovery. That's not going to work.
But it's a healthy coping mechanism to understand what led you to this addiction. And I think all of us go into counseling or mental health professions not just to help other people, but to also understand our shortcomings.
Yeah. And then, of course, help others. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today, and I think it's fantastic that you came on and you shared your story with all of us, and I'm sure others listening will also have been helped or had advice from what you've said today. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Congratulations.
For sure.
And
thank
here's
you.
To another 8 years.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
All
and
the very
just
best.
One more thing too, if I can just
please
say
go
to
ahead.
Those, the listeners who are out there, is that it really requires an integrative approach when you're deciding to make a change for resolving your addiction issues. You really need to involve the loved ones in your life, your friends, your family, your physicians, and mental health workers in order to succeed.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Absolutely. Well, we'll actually talk about that next, I think, and the importance of those people being in your life. Once again, thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Fantastic story there from our listener who is in recovery every day. Is another day towards another day in her life, and it's a fantastic success story there, I think, to hear. But one thing she did mention, and it's something that we wanted to talk about as well, is about the importance of family. It might not even be related family, it could just be very close friends around you, but that the importance of having some kind of connection with someone around you that can help. Sabine, do you want to come in and talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I mean, and from a psychological perspective, if we look at the attachment, the attachment style of people who fall into addictive behaviors, We more often than not find out that they have insecure attachment to their loved ones. So they are not very secure in their attachment style. There's a lot of anxiety. It raises anxiety. The person that is supposed to care for me and love me, are they going to stay? Are they going to leave me? There's a lot of any type of fear of rejection or abandonment can trigger and instigate all of these insecurities. And drugs or alcoholism can numb these feelings. It's emotional pain sometimes is very strong. And when we look at self-harmers, for example, they tell you that physical pain is more bearable than emotional pain.
Mm, yeah.
Because in a way, also self-harm can become addictive. I mean, it's not under substance use disorder, but in a way it is an addictive behavior because you want a relief of the pain. So talking about attachment, family, connectedness, if as a child you grew up in a family where you received a lot of validation, a lot of recognition, and you were not dismissed in whatever you were feeling, experiencing, thinking, and so on, you are more prone to have a secure attachment style. If, on the contrary, you were dismissed, neglected, or in extreme cases, abused, you were subject to trauma, definitely you have insecure attachment style, and then you don't view yourself or feel yourself as important enough in terms of self-love and self-care. So in that sense, drugs, alcohol, even though you cognitively know that it's self-destructive, but it doesn't matter. Because if your loved ones don't view you as important enough, then why should you?
Yeah.
So this is where it comes.
And it's almost self-perpetuating, isn't it, as well? Because
absolutely.
Then if you do reach out for these other substances or whatever it might be, then it's again making yourself, it's just more of that detachment. And again, going back to this TED talk, which I probably will do throughout the show because I thought it was just so interesting. He goes on to say that, you know, it's hard to love an addict. It's really hard.
Mm. Because they push and pull.
Because they push away.
Yeah, they push and pull.
And pull, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's hard to really be kind, to be loved, to give that love, when really sometimes that's all that is needed, is to actually deepen that connection. Mm. To deepen a connection with a person or a family person or a friend, as opposed to deepening in a connection with the substance or whatever it might be. We're actually joined on the line now. One of our callers has got some comments they'd like to share with us today. Hello, good afternoon.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon.
Now, I think you'd messaged in earlier and saying that you think that you may have a problem with alcohol. Is that right?
Yeah, I was drinking for years and years. To be honest, I lost track of how many years I was drinking. Like, it progressively got worse, up to a point where I was drunk 9 times a week. So basically double shift on the weekend.
Yeah.
Drunk by noon and drunk again in the afternoon or in the evening time. And that has led to lots and lots of trouble with my wife and close friends and family. So basically almost got a divorce. Mm-hmm. And I ended up moving out of the house for months, stayed with a friend, and basically it just felt like everything was going, you know, that's it for me, really.
Yeah.
Until my sister, she advised me to listen to Louise Hay, the motivational speaker, and I started listening to her meditations, and basically right from the first one, I realized that the reason why I was drinking so much is because I didn't like myself. I actually hated myself, and I didn't like life, didn't appreciate it. So I just started listening to her and started crying, and next thing I know, it just helped me put my finger on the pulse, you know. I just realized what was wrong, why I was drinking, and I took a mini vacation, not a vacation really, it's more just time out from life, went to Fujairah, stayed secluded for a couple of days. I originally took a bottle, an alcohol with me. Basically, I was on the phone with my other sister, and she told me, tell us, you know, you need to stop drinking. Basically, she told me, like, it's enough. You should stop it. So basically what I did, I just continued listening to Louise Hay. And I was talking to her. She told me just to dump all the alcohol. And I was like, all right, but I'm in a hotel room, and there's bottles in the hotel room. And at that moment, that particular moment, room service came, and they were like, hi, would you like us to restock your alcohol? Mm. I was like, actually, I would like you to get rid of it.
Good for
like,
you.
Like, what?
Mm.
Yeah, I was like, no, I need you to get rid of it. I don't want any alcohol in my room. So he took out all the mini bar, and I just emptied the bottle in the sink, and that's it. That was it. I stopped drinking.
Amazing. How long ago was that?
That was over a year ago, almost a year and a half ago.
Good for you. Congratulations. I mean, first of all, thank you. I mean, amazing story. Thank you for sharing it with us today, for coming on air, to have the courage to come and talk about it, because for sure there'll be others listening that I know that you'll be helping as well.
I hope so.
And, you know, I think, again, it keeps going back to, I think, what Sabine had said and what our other caller had said about the importance of family. And your sisters obviously played a fantastic role on those first steps to recovery, didn't they?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, pointing me in the right direction to listen to Louise Hay. And then just my other sister was like, Halas, it's time for you to stop, man. It's time for you to get your life back together.
Yeah.
And yeah, I've done that.
Hi, this is Prem speaking. Congratulations. That's
a
really amazing story. Now, I just wanted to add something. You and I have got something in common, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my sister made me stop as well.
Really?
cool. Yeah.
So we need to love our sisters a little more.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, they might be mean, especially when you're a kid, but, you know, it all works out in the end.
It does. Thank you for sharing this story. That's quite inspiring.
No worries. Thanks.
And again, I think, you know, we talked about one day at a time. It's one day at a time. Do you really feel that? Do you feel positive about the future?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm not going to lie. Sometimes I do feel like having a drink, but then I think to myself, it's like, okay, so I had a drink. Then what?
Yeah.
And actually, the thought of alcohol and the smell of it makes my stomach turn.
Mm, amazing, yeah.
Yeah, and just actually, just to add, after smoking for almost 25 years, last month I stopped smoking as well. I turned to vaping. I'm not really sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I also stopped smoking. So, yeah.
Fantastic. Brilliant. I mean, amazing. And is there anything that you'd like to say to listeners, maybe other people out there who are going through something similar like you, and maybe some words of advice at all?
Yes, I would like to say, if somebody tells you, I think you might have a problem, chances are you do have a problem, even though you don't think it, you don't believe it.
Yeah.
So you might want to listen and try to listen to yourself and find out exactly what's wrong. You know, it's not that I feel like drinking, that's it. You know, a lot of us used to say, I just feel like drinking, but there's an underlying problem which causes you to drink. So try to figure out what the problem is, and by sorting out that issue, you'll kick the habit, basically.
Well, we wish you all the very best on your journey.
Thank you.
One day at a time. And thank you once again for coming on and talking to us today. All the very best to you. Thank you. Wow, that's a really powerful story.
Can I just say something about the fact that, you know, some addicts can be in denial, most of them are, is that because they feel that as long as they are functioning, you know, they're sober during the week and maybe binge drinking over the weekend and it's become a lifestyle, this is where they tell you, no, I can stop any moment.
Yeah.
Anyway, I am sober and going to
functioning
work.
Functioning alcoholic or a functioning drug addict.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. So this is where the denial comes in. This is different from hitting rock bottom when you are kind of forced to acknowledge that, okay, this is not working anymore. Mm. But for many years, it works for you.
Mm-hmm.
People find some techniques, you know, to
hiding,
go around it and so on. So this is why, I mean, it's very difficult to accept because, okay, what are you blaming me for? I'm still functioning. So it's my own business if I continue drinking or not.
Yeah.
This is what you hear most of the time.
Yeah, and that last point I think he made was really important, is, you know, to say that if you feel that you have a problem, if someone comes to you who you respect and you love and whatever and says, I'm worried. I'm really worried about you. I think you have a problem. Then
you do have a problem.
Might be the time. Yeah, you might actually have a problem.
Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah. Just very quickly, we've got to go to the news. But yeah,
okay.
Please, Prem. Yeah.
No, I'm just going to say, add something to what you said earlier, Siobhan, about love. Yeah, how difficult it is to love an addict, and how difficult it is to actually like a person who's got an addiction problem. I think what we should look at is that people with addictions generally don't love themselves. That's one of the core reasons why they don't know how to love themselves. And after a while, it's so much about finding means to love myself, finding means to make myself feel better. And the substances do that.
Yeah.
Because drugs and alcohol actually provide you immediate gratification. You don't have to wait. You don't have to do something for a long time to get rewarded.
Mm.
So that's the fast, quick fix.
Mm, indeed.
Yeah, I thought I just wanted to add that.
No, great point there. Thank you very much, Prem. Let me just reintroduce our guests in the studio who are also sharing their knowledge and experience with us today. Sabine Scaff, a regular commentator and guest on the programme, co-owner of the Human Relations Institute and Clinics Assessments Director and a clinical psychologist. Welcome to you, Sabine. And Dr. Prem Shanmugam, who is the CEO and Clinical Director of Solas Sabha, which is Asia's leading addiction treatment centre. Dr. Prem, great to have you on the programme.
Thank you, Siobhan, for having me.
We're also joined now on the line by Kunal, who is from AAUAE. Thank you for your call today. Thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much.
Yeah, great to have you on the programme. Now, we've had a few callers already saying that they are in the recovery, they're in recovery from alcohol. And I think if those listening have not heard about this subject before in the UAE, they might be surprised or might be wondering, but is there an Alcoholics Anonymous in the UAE? Is there a Narcotics Anonymous right here in the UAE? There is. And it's very much functioning. And Kunal, perhaps you can talk to us a little bit about the role of it in the UAE.
Yeah, Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous both are very established and present in the UAE. We have many meetings throughout the week, different places across the city, including Abu Dhabi, Sharjah, Al Ain. And our role is to help the still suffering alcoholic or the addict who might want recovery. And we have we are a worldwide fellowship, more than 80 years track record of helping recovering alcoholics and addicts find a new way to life.
Yeah. And is it just a phone call? How do people listening now think if they do have a problem? What was the first step? What would you say to them? What would you say to do?
Well, we have helplines for both the fellowships, which can be reached via the website. One can find aa.net or na.org. Then they can find the website and the helpline phone number.
Yeah.
You can just call us. It's a 24/7 manned helpline. And the first step would be to just talk to us. We then would invite you probably to meet with us in our meetings, which happen across the Emirates. And then we take it from there.
And do you follow the 12-step program?
Yes, both the fellowships are 12-step programs, yes. Mm.
Can you talk me through those a little bit?
Well, the first stage for any alcoholic or addict is to recognize and admit that they have a problem. It's the breaking of the denial, which is a challenge sometimes in the beginning. So to admit that they have a problem is the first beginning step. And from there, we then start seeking help through a fellowship of recovering alcoholics and addicts who help each other. So sometimes when one addict or one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic and shares the experience, the identification is very strong. We understand the story, we understand the challenges, we understand the mental makeup. We also understand the current state of feelings that a person might be going through. And therefore, that identification helps relate to each other much better.
Mm.
And we can then connect with each other. And the sense of trust and confidence comes and hope comes from each other, where that if this person who seems to be like me, think like me, talk like me, has had life circumstances like me, has found a way to stop, then maybe I too can. And that's where it all begins. That's the core of the fellowship between us.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, of course, we have a structured program where we work through, you know, who we are, where we come from, and how we can help each other stay clean and sober.
Yeah. Do you also refer to psychiatrists or counselors, or is there an offer of talking to someone outside of the circle?
No, Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous has no relationship with anybody else. We, however, would love to collaborate with anybody. Anybody can help us or we can work with them. But there is no referral system as such, no.
Yeah. And Prem, Dr. Prem is here. Did you sort of have experience with these sorts of places as well on your recovery?
Oh, yes, I did. Hi, Kunal. How are you doing?
Hi. I'm good, Dr. Prem. Good to hear from you again.
Excellent. Thank you for sharing that information, because we have quite a few patients who come from this region to Malaysia for treatment as well. And very often when they come back, we look for places to refer them back to the 12-step programs. My initial exposure to treatment was the AA, Alcoholics Anonymous groups. And I think one of the strongest messages that I received in the group was that I'm not alone. And this was very powerful for me at that point of time. It was, you're not suffering alone. Whatever you have gone through, we have gone through too, and you're okay. You know, we are here to help you through this. It's not that difficult. We can do it one day at a time.
Yeah.
That's where I learned the message.
Mm.
And I think you guys are doing an excellent job. You know, really fantastic.
Thank you.
And anybody is welcome. Any nationality, any age. Is that right? I mean, anyone can come.
Absolutely. We are a very diverse group. Men, women across all ages, all nationalities, all cultures, all ethnicities. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking or stop using. There are no dues or fees for any membership. We are a self-supporting fellowship through our own contribution. We are not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or any institution. We don't wish to engage in any controversy. We don't endorse nor oppose any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay clean and sober and help others to achieve sobriety and get clean.
And it's anonymous as well, or it can be?
Oh, absolutely, yes. We refer to ourselves only as by our first names, and we can even use any other name if we want. We are very, very sensitive about our own anonymity, and we are very we protect others' anonymity also. Mm-hmm. And it's very safe, and you know, we are under no surveillance or any scrutiny. We have in fact been very well recognized and supported by government institutions who also want the same. They want the community to be clean and sober, so they have always been very supportive to us.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit about life after addiction. Is there such a thing?
Oh, of course, yeah, certainly. I've been clean and sober for many, many years, and I've got my life back, certainly, yes. I was an alcoholic who had lost nearly everything, and I was divorced and unemployable and bankrupt and physically very, very ill. And I came into the program many years ago, and since then I've been stitching my life back together, and you know, it's been a wonderful journey. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the best thing is that I don't feel like drinking or using anymore. So the whole obsession has left us.
And it's worked. It's working. It's working for you.
Absolutely.
It's working for all the other people that are joining you
absolutely
as well in AA.
Yes. We are growing very, very well here. We've been in the region for about more than 20 years. And I think they are very long-term, old-time members who have shown the way, who have started this journey. And there are many young and newcomers coming in. So we are growing all the time.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. I mean, Kunal, thank you so much. It's really great to know that there is help out there. There are foundations. There
absolutely
are people who, you're not alone. I think, as Prem had mentioned as well, it's something that's really important to understand, that there is help. There are people you can talk to, and they are available. They're free. We'll give the numbers. We'll give the websites out as well for those listening to
Absolutely. So just thank you very much for giving us an opportunity to share this message. Anybody out there who needs any help of any sort, and even if they have any doubt, and we also welcome calls from family members who might, you know, want some help in trying to, you know, make some talk to their family members.
Yeah.
So we are here to help.
That's a really good point. Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us on the phone today. All
thank
the very
you,
best to you. Thank you.
Bye.
That was Kunal there from AAUAE. Just a quick give out of those websites. AA.net is Alcoholics Anonymous, and NA.org is Narcotics Anonymous. As he mentioned, you just call up, someone will be there 24/7, go to a meeting. Or in fact, he mentioned just at the end there, which I think is really important, we're going to sort of perhaps just lead into now, is about family again. That it could be a friend, it could be a family member who is worried about somebody, they can call up as well and get advice. It doesn't have to just be the person who is an addict that has to call, but someone else can get advice from them and help them as well on their journey. We talked a little bit about life after addiction as well, and some of the challenges of that. And there's some quite scary statistics, actually, about people that have given up, for example, alcohol and been done really well for, like, I think the average is about 4 to 5 years, and then going back to it after that amount of time, there's quite a high percentage of people that relapse for whatever reason it might be. And it's about having that help. The initial help is there, possibly, to help you on the way, to help you with that initial recovery, but it's something that has to be set in place possibly for the rest of your life, isn't it? How do you do that? Well, how do you make that, how do you start that?
See, well, addiction is a disease. First of all, we need to recognize this. Okay, it's just like diabetes or hypertension or cancer, or just like any other illness, relapses are possible. People do slip. People do relapse once in a while. If you're a diabetic, you're told not to eat certain kinds of food, not to eat too much of ice cream, not to eat too much of chocolate, but diabetics do. You know, they do slip.
Yeah.
But then what they do is they take their medication and they come back on track. So addiction is like that. If people do slip or do relapse, then what's important is they recognize treatment works, they do come back. Now, there is this thing called the stages of change, which is a theory developed by some psychologists many years ago. And they say that in order for people can go through these stages 4 times before they reach some kind of stability.
Really, right.
Yeah. Which could mean it's possible for a person to relapse 4 times before they reach some kind of stability. It could mean that. There's a possibility as well. So we need to look at it as a disease. And having these self-support groups, AA, Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, clinics, support systems in the community is very helpful, because then they know where to go back when they need that help.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know what to do. You know where to reach for.
You also have to recognize some of the triggers and maintaining, you know, self-care and preventing relapse. And one of the things that I found is the halt is relapse is more likely when one is hungry, angry, lonely, and tired.
Mm.
So you need to also, when we talk about support system, inform the people around you that these, what are your own triggers, and to ask them for help to manage these triggers so relapse becomes evitable rather than inevitable.
Yeah. There's interesting as well, perhaps we can go through the five ways for addicts to cope and avoid relapse. There's five methods. We'll do that on our return on Dubai Today. We're talking about addiction on the show this afternoon. We have got two wonderful experts joining us in the studio as well. Sabine Scaff, who is a clinical psychologist, and Dr. Prem Shanmugam, who is Asia's leading addiction treatment centre, as the head of that, the CEO and the clinical director. Welcome to you both again. We've talked quite a lot about family. We've talked quite a lot about friends and family and how they, in fact, can assist on that road to recovery. Prem, I know you wanted to go into that a little bit more detail. What can families do and how do they help?
Okay. We say that addiction not only inflicts the individual, it actually affects the whole family as well. So the whole family dynamics shifts. Okay, let me explain this with a case study. So we have a father, we have a mother, we have children, we have three kids or two kids. Now they're functioning. The father goes to work, comes back, mom does whatever she does, kids go to school, they function normally, they grow, they evolve, daily issues. Suddenly you have this disease called addiction that inflicts. Comes in, one person gets affected, say the son or the child. Now, when that one individual gets affected by the addiction, what automatically happens is the family comes together to protect. Families find balance. They find a homeostasis to function. This is the normal purpose of a family.
Yeah, if you're in a functioning family.
If you're in a functioning family, yeah. Exactly, of course. So when that happens, the family dynamics shift and everyone takes on different kinds of roles to protect the person who's addicted. Now, sometimes this means of protection can be unhealthy, can become a way of protecting him, but allowing him to continue his addiction.
Enabling him.
Enabling, yeah. We call this, enabling or codependent behavior.
How do you do that, though? What does that look like?
Well, for example, let's say he comes home and he says, oh, I need money now. You know, if you don't give me money, I'm going to whatever.
Hurt myself.
Yeah. Or steal. Or run away.
Yes, exactly.
Right? So mom gets scared and mom gives him $50 or some whatever. And he goes out. What does he do with the money? He spends it to buy drugs.
Right, yeah.
What mom is doing is actually encouraging him to continue with his addiction. Thinking that she's protecting him. Of course, she loves him dearly. There's no doubt about it. But she doesn't know any other way to help him. So this becomes a dysfunctional way. What happens is father also changes roles. He may become more distant from the family now because there's a problem. Now, the other sibling or the other child at home looks at the problem at home and says, whoa, I'm neglected. So I need to do other things. I need to function in school or I need to do stuff on my own. And the other child gets neglected. So all the roles shift. The dynamics shift, but what is constant is the addiction continues.
Exactly.
Yeah. So there's not really affecting that. Sorry, Sabine. Yeah.
Go ahead. There's a lot of guilt also involved
in
these types of behaviors because, you know, ultimately the parents start questioning, did we do a good job? Are we good parents? I mean, what is it? For example, in the case of that mom, this is the only way that she can show her son at that moment that she cares. It's not the best way,
but
this is stemming out of guilt as well. Maybe I have not done a good job and so on.
And we hear this very often in treatment.
Yeah,
when they come into treatment, the first thing the parent says, I think I was not a good parent, you know, I should have done better. Yeah, it's my fault. So actually, it's not your fault. Your child is not well, you know, your loved one has got a problem. He needs to be treated. And now as a result of that, the whole family needs the support and the help.
And I think you're right bringing that point in, Sabine, in that a lot of the time, you know, you're referring to addiction as a disease, and oftentimes, and most of the time, you hear it's not. It's treated with punishment. It could be jail, even. It could be whatever. It's treated as something that's shameful. It's treated as you're labelled, or you know, it's some kind of cowardliness, or you can't, you know,
you're
or weak-willed,
weak.
Or you know,
exactly.
you can't. And there's all these negative connotations. When actually, again, turning it around, and I think this is what you said, which actually was the first step to your recovery, was that when someone said to you, no, it's actually a disease.
Yes.
You see, when we jail someone, we punish them for the crime they committed as a result of the addiction.
Exactly.
But the addiction is not treated. So you punish the crime, Okay, you pay for your crime, but what about my addiction? Who's going to treat my addiction, right?
Yeah.
So I come out again and my addiction continues. So I commit more crimes. Then I go back and get punished again. Until the addiction is treated, this person will continue to commit the crimes.
What advice would you offer then to families who are in any of those particular situations?
Seek help.
Yeah.
You know, you love your child. You love your family very much. There's no doubt about it. But allow the professionals to help. You can't help them. You can love them, which they need very much. Importantly, you need to love yourself. The more codependent you become on your loved one, you're feeding into the addiction. Mm-hmm. Stop that.
Right. You talk about yourself. Codependent.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Okay. Now, codependency basically means the dependency on the addict who's dependent on the substance.
Okay.
Okay, that confused. Okay. So there is a relationship here between the, let's assume the mother.
Right.
Yeah. The mother loves her son so much that she encourages, in a way, for the son to continue his relationship with his addiction by giving him money, feeding him,
mm-hmm.
allowing him to do the things he does. Now, he continues with his relationship, but she is continuing by allowing him to continue his addiction.
Right.
What happens? Now, this happens in treatment. When the individual gets into treatment, gets into a rehab or gets into a treatment program, suddenly the mother realizes, now, wait a minute, where's my role?
Mm. Exactly.
Okay.
So there's a change in dynamics.
Yeah, dynamic shifts. So now she thinks, oh, okay, my son is no more on. You know, what's my purpose? What's my role? Sometimes, ironically, these people can jeopardize the treatment of their loved ones.
Absolutely. I think, Dr. Prem, you're talking about secondary benefits.
Oh, yes.
And symptom children and dysfunctional families. When in a dysfunctional family, it's only one child that takes on the role. And that is the problematic child,
right.
If you want. And this child is the troublemaker and is assigned by the family unconsciously as the troublemaker. And then when there is treatment and eventually cure, then the whole dynamics needs to shift as well. So as you were saying, Dr. Prem, tackling the root cause is what is most important. Mm. Otherwise, addictions can move into other areas of life as well.
So you're saying that sometimes family members could actually sabotage the recovery of a loved one?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Of course, they don't realize it, you see. They think they're doing it out of love. But it damages it affects the individual who's got the addiction problem.
Yeah,
we have seen cases in our facility in Solace in Malaysia where the family member discharges the loved one from treatment, giving all excuses because they need that relationship to take him back home.
Yeah.
Until it gets really bad.
The caretaker.
Yeah.
And a lot of people become addicts or seek substance abuse to get the secondary benefits, to get, it's more of an attention seeking at that point in their life. So addiction in itself has many functions, psychological function in a specific family.
Yeah.
And that's why when it comes to treatment, everyone needs to get into treatment. We need to help everybody.
Yeah. It's like a family intervention.
Yes,
exactly. You said it's not just the individual, it's the whole family that
needs to have
treatment or to talk to someone or to get help.
It is.
We were just discussing earlier about prescription drugs, and there's a huge rise in addiction to prescription drugs. I'm just wondering, and I'm trying to understand why and how this is happening. I mean, is this because of the availability? Is this because it's becoming easier to be prescribed drugs that these addictions are happening? I mean, sure, you can't become addicted unless you've actually got hold of the drugs. What's going on that this has been such a rise, do you think, Prem?
Well, I think one thing is accessibility and availability. That's one thing that we need to deal with. Like I was saying earlier, when you see a doctor, you need to talk about the actual reasons why you're there. If someone is manipulating the doctor, it's very easy for the doctor to just give in and give you what you want. I wouldn't say it's the doctor's fault at all.
It's called doctor shopping, isn't it?
Doctor shopping, exactly.
Yeah, where you basically go around to various different doctors
if you
are in need of, wanting some form of prescription drugs that you're only allowed a certain amount of.
See, once you're in an addictive state, once the person's brain is in an addictive state, then manipulation and deceit and malingering, like you rightfully said earlier, is part of the symptoms of addiction. So in order for me to get my drugs, I will do whatever it takes. So I go and see this doctor, you know, I say what I need to, I get what I want. I go see another doctor, I get a prescription, I get what I need and I want, and then I move on. I wouldn't say it's the doctor's fault.
actually. I wouldn't blame them. They're doing
an
excellent job.
Surely there should be some form of, or is there some form of cooperation amongst psychotherapists, physiotherapists, I mean, whatever, doctors, clinics, pharmacies, hospitals?
There is here in the UAE, and there has recently been a law. I'm not sure whether the implementation has started or not, by the Dubai Health Authority, saying that only psychiatrists can prescribe psychiatric medication, not GPs, not family doctors, not anyone who is not a psychiatrist, which minimizes the misuse and prescribing medication that is out of your area of expertise, which helps, of course, control prescription drug addiction.
Mm. So it's a lot more difficult to do so. And I think obviously here within the restrictions of living in within the UAE as well, there are obviously certain drugs that aren't allowed here that perhaps are allowed other places.
Yes.
In your field, do you find that it has to be something that really requires drugs? It's not that easy in your field, would you say? Or easily for a doctor to write out a prescription?
Usually, these prescription medications are very well controlled here, as they should be, of course. However, this is an expat community, so a lot of expats do get their prescription medication from outside of the UAE, from their own doctor back home. So this is very difficult at,
it's gonna be able to monitor. It's very, mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So a lot of people don't go to doctors here, they go to their doctors back home, and then how can you monitor the misuse of prescription medication?
Yeah.
And I think it's not only happening in UAE, it's global, it happens in other countries as well.
Mm.
I can go back anywhere to my doctor in another country, in my country, and get what I need and come back.
And come back again, and there's no global cross communication or understanding about how much people are taking.
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? Because you have a doctor's prescription with you in your hand, and you're having the medication, so how can that be questioned?
Yeah.
So it's a bit difficult.
It's really interesting. Just bring a quick story in, if I may, about, I didn't know this person, but I do know the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but Flea, I think Flea is the bassist, yes. And he has struggled with drugs since a very young age, and then finally he did get clean, as he says, which was because of his family, he said. But then he went on to break his arm. Of course, if you're a bassist, you need your arm to play guitar. And it was obviously a big trauma for him. And he opened up about his recent experiences with oxytocin and how the medical community, he felt, made it very easy for him to get addicted to opioids. He has it. It's a history of him. Perhaps that wasn't something that they'd looked at when they then prescribed him with these drugs. And he found that, and I'm just quoting from the article, he writes that the dealers in the seedy world of narcotics have changed from the scary gun-toting criminals to healthcare providers. It's quite a strong statement.
Yes.
But in his case, and he has a very good case to put forward, that's what happened. He broke his arm snowboarding and had to have major surgery. His doctor put it back together perfectly, and thanks to him, he can still play bass with all his heart, bass, I should say. But he also gave me a 2-month supply of oxytocin, and if he wanted more, he could have got a refill very easily.
Well,
it's just to highlight this, you know, and I think whenever someone with a famous name behind them talks about these sorts of things, it hits the headlines. And I think it's a good point to raise.
It's also possible that he could have been predisposed and he never knew. You see, so maybe he already had a deficiency in his brain where he would be addicted to oxytocin once he tries it. He never knew that the doctor did not know that.
Regardless of his previous experience.
So that's a possibility. Like I was saying earlier, there is a predisposition. Some people organically have a deficiency in the reward system and they need to self-medicate.
Yeah.
So that's a possibility. We wouldn't know.
Right. I'm quickly moving on because I am very conscious of time, and there's a message that come through that perhaps we can end on this last message. Thank you very much for texting in. Hello. Can I ask about support for addicts' families who don't want to go for treatments? Codependency is a big problem for families as well. Thank you. We have touched on this earlier, but perhaps we can just go back to that point.
I like I mentioned earlier, this is a disease that affects the whole family. It's not that one person, and every individual in the family needs support and needs help. Because when recovery happens not alone as well. Recovery has to happen as a unit. And that's one of the reasons why also the AA and the NA groups are successful. Because they're not alone. They have a strong support group.
Yeah.
Family help, see a family therapist. See a psychologist, you know. Look out for psychologists and talk to them and meet them.
And Sabine, final thoughts from yourself on the subject?
I think when we work with people who have who are suffering from addiction, again, we need to look at their whole history, you know, their support system, anything that we can provide for them to be able to stop is welcomed, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And not look at them as diseased, but as people with a disease. Mm-hmm. You know, I think bring back in the humanistic perspective of that.
Mm. And I think that there is help out there. We heard
earlier, of course,
from Kamal as well. Let me give you out those details. Kamal was talking to us about AAUAE. If you feel that you'd like to give them a call today about yourself or for someone else, then you can do so and get their numbers on AA.net, that's Alcoholics Anonymous, or NANarcoticsAnonymous.org. The phone numbers are there. They will be available 24 hours. A big thank you to both of you.
Thank you so much for
joining us on the programme today. Sabine Scaff, co-owner of the Human Relations Institute and Clinics and a clinical psychologist. Great to have you on the show. And a big thanks to Dr. Prem, who's the CEO and clinical director of Solas Sabah, Asia's leading addiction treatment centre. You've just opened an office in Abu Dhabi as well, haven't
you? Yes.
Great work that you're doing. And
thank
you so much for sharing your experiences on the show with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.